Good Monday morning. How's your day going so far this morning? Hope you're having a good one. It is 10:06 right now. Hi there, and welcome to the second hour of our show this morning. I'm Rick Howe with you until 12:30 this afternoon. And here's what's ahead on the show for you today. We've got another edition of Science Files coming up this hour. And St. Mary's University astrophysicist Rob Thacker joins me this morning. I'll make the introduction in just a moment. Then after the news at 11, it's your turn to sound off as we begin this new week. We've got an open hour for you next hour. We call it Manic Monday. And of course, as always, anything goes. After the news at noon, the Nova Scotia Health Coalition's Chris Parsons will share some thoughts on news patients are being turned away from ERs because of staff shortages and busy workloads. And we'll hear another Halifax history moment when historian and author Blair Bead joins me this afternoon. But this hour, it is time for Science Files, and joining me in the studio this morning is St. Mary's University astrophysicist Dr. Rob Thacker. Good morning, Dr. Rob.
Good morning.
And how are you this morning?
I am a lot better than I was 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, you were hurting you there 2 weeks ago.
Oh, yeah, no, Katie was like, do you want some ginger tea or something?
Yeah, there you go. But everybody's on the road to recovery here now, and that's a good thing. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. If you've got a question for Dr. Rob this morning, give us a call, just like Wayne has done here. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning, gentlemen.
How are you?
I'm very well. A few weeks, months ago, I don't know, Dr. Thacker, you explained that black holes basically evaporate away. And I wasn't very sharp when you gave that answer because I had a follow-up question. Mm-hmm. If that happens, then that must mean that the gravitational force that even stops light from escaping has to lessen in order for things just to wander off. And I wonder, could you just explain what happens and why that gravity would lessen?
Okay, so this is actually a question of the forms of energy and how they changed. And so I should say that this concept of evaporating black holes through Hawking radiation, the thing that you have to remember about this is, in our day-to-day universe, this is hardly ever going to be happening. It really only applies to very, very tiny black holes, which admittedly could be out there, but we don't see very much evidence for them. So the really big black holes, like the really big ones in the center of galaxies that are, I don't know, sometimes billions of times more massive than the sun, they're not evaporating away, okay? So don't think too much about that. But with the Hawking radiation itself, when you get very sort of like microscopic miniature black holes and they are going through it, yes, you're absolutely right that over a period of time, as these things evaporate, basically the energy that's associated with the gravitational field has to be turned into another form and basically sent away as radiation. The precise details of that are still a challenge to figure out at some level. We have a number of things we don't understand in terms of what happens to information that falls into black holes. That's a really big issue. But yeah, your point that gravitational energy that was pulling things in has to go somewhere is absolutely true, because you're changing mass from basically being in what we would call a massive form, like the stuff that you and I are made of, into a massless form, which is radiation. So you're right. That energy goes away basically in the radiation itself. But like, I do want to be completely clear that Hawking radiation is only really something that has a big impact on very, very, very small black holes. For very, very big black holes, while technically it's there, there's going to be so many other things going on with stuff falling into the black hole that really the Hawking radiation is sort of like not an issue for those things compared to very tiny microscopic black holes.
Just for reference, how big would one of these tiny black holes be?
Oh, absolutely minuscule. I mean, we're talking fractions of the size. I think... I don't want to speculate because that would be bad on me, but they're much, much smaller, sort of microscopic, smaller than a few centimeters or whatever. We're talking
not big enough.
You couldn't
grab one with your hand or anything like that.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to be doing that too much.
But these
are really, really sort of tiny black holes that we're talking about. So there's a possibility that these things are actually created in processes that happened just after the Big Bang as well.
And did you say why the gravity would lessen?
It's just because you're converting that gravitational energy into radiation. So you basically send it away.
Because energy can't ever go away. It always is somewhere.
It's converted into another form. That's absolutely right. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks so much.
No problem.
Thanks, Wayne.
I feel better.
All right, bye-bye. Now, there are these huge black holes out there that are gobbling up planets, right?
Nom, nom, nom. I mean, planets, stars, you name it. I mean, black holes in the centers of galaxies are swallowing up giant clouds of gas that actually would be the sort of stellar nurseries. So that's happening probably in the middle of our galaxy
as well.
Yeah,
that's my next question. Is there a black hole in the Milky Way
galaxy? Oh, yeah. No, Sagittarius A star, as it's called. Oh. It's I think it's about 6 million times the mass of the sun is the best estimate we have. But there's a fantastic movie online created by a scientist called Andrea Ghez and her group at UCLA, I think. I can't remember where she is now. So they've plotted up actual orbits of stars around the black hole. So you can see orbits of stars around something. It's really very cool.
The black hole's next victims.
Possibly, yes. So what we're hoping with the next generation of really giant telescopes is we'll be able to go in and we'll be able to see more stars that are orbiting around that black hole. And once we can do that, we can actually start doing really detailed measurements of what's happening in the gravitational environment around the black hole and test relativity and things like that.
So these black holes moving at all, or are they just sitting there? And
they're not moving very much because they really kind of are sitting at the bottom of the, you think of it, the gravity well of the whole galaxy.
Yeah.
And it's natural for very, very heavy things to sit right at the bottom of that gravity well. It will be spinning, right? That's pretty much certain. So it'll be rotating around, but it won't be moving too much relative to the overall gravity of the galaxy. Now, having said all of that, there is a possibility when you actually have a merger of black holes, a number of them at any one time, you can get one of them thrown out at thousands of kilometers a second. And so there's all sorts of interesting things we do in terms of going and looking for evidence of those black holes being thrown out of systems.
But our planet and the planets within our solar system, we're not at any risk of becoming
For us?
Yeah.
No, we're totally fine. I mean, these things are just absolutely ridiculously far away. I mean, we don't have to worry about that.
Oof.
It's Monday, Rick. I wouldn't drop that on you. It's Monday.
But there's another story suggesting that scientists were surprised to discover a meteor had exploded over the Bering Sea in December.
Yeah.
This blast went unnoticed by astronomers who track meteors. And that's a little bit concerning, isn't it?
I don't like making people lose sleep at night about these things. But at the same time, people do need to be aware that there are things coming into the atmosphere all the time. And so I think there's an estimate that if you go down to really, really tiny particles, like sort of like flakes of dust raining down from space, then there's about, I think it's several tens of thousands of tons landing on the Earth's atmosphere every day.
Yep.
But the thing is, it's really small things that there's many, many of. The bigger things, there's fewer of. But all of that said, this is another example of something that was probably slightly smaller than the Chelyabinsk meteor. So that was the one over Russia a few years ago.
Yep.
And that was, but this is still hundreds of kilotons.
Yeah.
Right? So several times the Hiroshima bomb.
Ten times more energy than the atomic bomb on Hiroshima.
There we go. So yes, I mean, these things actually are happening relatively regularly, like once in less than a handful of years, actually, in this particular case. So yeah, these things are coming down and hitting us all the time. The thing to remember, though, is that 70% of the Earth's surface is covered in water. So in terms of whether people see these things, that immediately brings the probability that someone sees it, just observing it, much, much lower. But at the same time, of course, all of the warning systems that are detecting stuff and so on, they are tracking it, but someone has to sit down and go through the data, which is exactly what happened here. Actually, one of my former colleagues who was doing a PhD at the same time I was, Peter Brown.
Okay, he's with the University.
At the University of Western Ontario, was one of the people who found this looking over the data. So, yeah, it's like we are recording all of this stuff, but if someone isn't going in and actually checking on it and looking for the things that we want to see, then we don't always know they're there.
Yeah, I'm reading a story here that says, but the latest event over the Bering Sea shows that larger objects can collide with us without warning, underlining the need for enhanced monitoring.
Yeah, no. So I mean, as amazing as, say, Chelyabinsk was, because it exploded fairly high up, it broke a lot of windows, created a few sort of hospital things, but it didn't really do a tremendous amount of damage. But all you need is something slightly bigger than that, like twice the size, and then we could be start looking at something that really does do a bit of damage.
So this particular rock, again, 10 times the energy than the atomic bomb that dropped on Hiroshima, if it had hit land, it would have caused significant damage, right?
I think the details on this are that the explosion was far enough up that it wasn't too bad. You will still obviously get shockwaves coming down from it that do the damage. That's exactly what happened with Telyabinsk. So in this particular case, I don't think it would have been too bad. But like I said, it only needs to be a little bit bigger, and then you've got something that could do a lot of damage if it lands over a populated area. But as we've just said, the probability of hitting a populated area is actually really quite low. I think it's maybe 1% or something like that. So we are saved a bit by that, to be honest.
This happened December 18th last year. It says here, a large meteor streaked across the sky over the Bering Sea before exploding. Despite having an estimated diameter of 10 meters, the meteor entered our atmosphere unnoticed by astronomers at an estimated speed of 32 kilometers per second. Wow,
yeah, it was going fast. Yeah. I mean, they are going fast inevitably because orbital interactions, our orbital speed is high, so whenever we come into contact with something else, inevitably that's going to be a fast interaction too. But there's a beautiful plot in the BBC article on this showing all of the different impacts that have been recorded, events that have been recorded. And yeah, there's a lot of them over the past few years. So it sort of does make you sit up and think, you know,
What do we have now is kind of early warning devices. Is this simply telescopes that are
Pretty much. I mean, we have radar for things as well, so we can always do radar tracking. But it's not like we're doing surveys down to sort of like the 10 meter size. That's really kind of tricky to do. With those things, you kind of see them at the last minute, if at all, right? Mm-hmm. So there's only so much you can do, and we will be having a new telescope coming online in 2022 called the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope. That will survey the southern sky completely every 3 days. So that should find a lot more of these things. But, you know, there are things that it can't see. It can't see things that are coming at us from the direction of the sun and things like that. So there's always other things that we can do, like putting telescopes up in space that allow us to look in that direction as well.
10:18 is our time. He is Dr. Rob Thacker, and this is Science Files. Benita, stay there. We'll get to you in just a moment, but first we have to take a quick break. We'll be back with more with Dr. Rob right after this. Ten 21, our time here on a Monday morning. Dr. Rob Thacker is with us. This is Science Files, and Robert just sent us an email saying, since our brains and our hearts are functioning largely because of electricity, would it be fair to say that we will live forever, given that our energy will be transformed into another form?
It's a philosophical question, really, isn't it? Yeah. So I have to admit, I often think about this in a perhaps a slightly more romantic context, in the sense that when you remember people who've passed on, that you keep a bit of them with you.
Yeah.
And that's just sort of like their influence carries on even though they've passed away. But in terms of all of the electrical signals, I mean, so there's kind of an interesting point there, and it taps into what are we when we're living, right? And that is, what's consciousness?
Okay.
Right? And so the honest answer is, we still don't know. We know a lot of things that correlate with consciousness in the activity of the brain, but it's one of those things that we can't really explain. And so you kind of wonder, with the growth in sort of research in artificial intelligence, whether we might at some point be able to find out what this thing is. But to come back to the question, I think the honest answer is, the energy and the material that makes us up, yes, that will exist forever. But we are the combination of that material and the way that material interacts. And when those things stop interacting in the ways that allow us to be living things, to be conscious and so on, then you can kind of argue that the state that is us actually goes away, right? And what you end up having is basically a bunch of meat that is going to get eaten by bacteria and so on, and then turned into other forms. So in a funny kind of way, I'm going to have to say that although the energy that makes us up, yes, that's converted into other forms, goes elsewhere and so on, the state that is us, I think you can literally say, does have an endpoint, and that's when we die.
So our soul doesn't leave our body. That's what I'm going to call us, a soul.
No, I mean, I've got to be honest and say that I'm not particularly religious. I mean, I'm not going to get on people who are religious. That's totally their choice. So in this particular case, I'll talk about consciousness and the state of consciousness. And it's clear, like, when you go to sleep, your consciousness goes away. Right? Yeah. So that's gone. And so when you die, it seems to be the same thing, that when you have brain death, consciousness goes away, right? And so the state that is you has gone.
But we hear stories, for example, people who been on operating tables and died but came back to life. They've told stories about floating above everything and watching it.
I completely understand what you're talking about. So there's been a fair amount of research on this and hallucinogenic states and so on in the brain and so on. And so I think that's not necessarily something we should get too amazed by, because, like, you can have dream experiences that are not entirely different from that. But the thing with people who are sort of like, they talk about being clinically dead and being revived and so on, those are always very short periods of time,
yeah,
right? And so you haven't had a lot of time for, like, brain starvation, for oxygen and things like that, to do serious damage to the function of the brain. And similarly with the heart as well. So that, I think, it's a bit different, right? So if someone does die of sudden heart failure or whatever, and the heart potentially could be revived, then you've got, like, a ticking time clock of how the damage is being done. Mm-hmm. Right, to the overall brain. Yep. Particularly, your brain is the biggest thing you've got to worry about. It's this amazing thing that nature has developed over billions, well, not billions in our case, I guess a couple of hundred thousand years, but no, it's
still evolving.
Yeah, so my opinion on the question is, as much as I would tend to agree, like, I'm not religious, but I'm kind of spiritual in a way. Like, I feel a profound connection to the universe, because all of the energy in anything, like this cup on the desk or whatever, you, me, and so on, all of that energy was created in the Big Bang. So I feel this kind of spiritual connection, in the sense that there is something that happened billions of years ago that connects us all.
Yep.
Right? And but me, once I die, yeah, I'm gone. Right? Yep. I'm still in people's memories. I'm still influencing, but yeah, I'm gone. But in a way, that's what makes us so amazing, right? So we have these lives on this planet, and try and enjoy the moments if you can. I mean, I appreciate that not everyone can, and some people in really difficult situations, some people have medical issues and so on, but it's kind of amazing.
It is. It's truly amazing. The human body, the human person, this life on this planet. Bonita, good morning.
Morning, gentlemen. My question is about the dimensions. What are the five dimensions, and are there more than five? What is the fifth dimension?
All right. Thank you, Benita.
All right. So,
what are dimensions?
So,
how many are there?
Well, four is the normal answer, right? So we have three of space and one of time.
Yeah.
So dimensions do get talked about there being more of them in the context of various different theories of particle physics, in particular things like string theory. They talk about there being extra dimensions and so on. And we need those just for beautiful properties of the mathematics in those dimensions. But in general, no. When we talk about, say, Einstein's theory of relativity, right? That's probably the best thing to use that people may have heard a little bit about. And so then we talk about three dimensions of space and one of time. And that always kind of foxes people a little bit, because we think that time is really this thing, whereas space dimensions, spatial dimensions like left, back, up, down, and so on, those we kind of understand intrinsically, whereas time is this very unusual and different thing that we can't sort of go forwards and backwards in time. We know that. And it was
whoa, but just one second here. I'm looking at a headline here that says, scientists turn back time with quantum
computer. Yeah. But what you've got to remember is that's a bit of clickbait from the scientists. So they're talking about changing the state of a quantum computer that actually changes it relative to what it was in the past. So you have to be super careful with that.
All right.
Right. So, but nonetheless, so dimensions literally are the dimensions of space and then the dimension of time. Now, in relativity, it's kind of amazing, because that shows you that you can actually interchange time and space, which is really amazing. And even inside black holes, let's get all really trippy, the actual role of space and time can actually swap in an amazing way. But of course, we could never put someone in a black hole to tell us what that
Would
was
that
like.
Would that be neat, though, if we could, huh?
You could actually go into the black hole and go through that, but you would never be able to tell anyone about it. So, So basically, it's the sort of spatial dimensions, the front, back, up, down, and so on, and then you have time as well. And so those are combined into one thing, one four-dimensional thing called space-time in Einstein's theory of relativity.
Very interesting. Yeah. 10:28 is the time. Here's Dr. Rob Thacker, and this is Science Files. We're going to take a quick break right now, though. We've got a news update coming up, and then another half hour to go yet. With Dr. Rob, we'll be back after the news, and the news is coming up next. 10:33 here. It's a Monday morning Science Files with Dr. Rob Thacker. He's an astrophysicist at St. Mary's University, and he's here to answer your questions. And if you've got a question for us, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Researchers get humans to think like computers.
Yeah, okay.
It's the headline here. Now, what's this all about?
I love this one. So we were just talking before we came on. So a few years ago now, there was a meme on the internet, Chihuahua or Blueberry Muffin, right? And so there were these pictures of the tops of Blueberry Muffins and then Chihuahuas. And of course, lo and behold, they kind of look similar.
Well, they do.
I know. Like three black spots. And so that was actually came out of research where people were using pictures of Blueberry Muffins and Chihuahuas to see whether computer recognition systems could tell the difference. And so they struggled. And so what scientists have been pointing out is that computers do image recognition. They're trying to make it more and more like humans, but they still make mistakes that we wouldn't.
So this is a computer tester, computer brainiac tester.
Right, exactly. And so everyone is trying, the researchers are trying to make these systems more accurate. And so a lot of the things they do is mimicking the algorithms that we think humans use. And so that's one particular thrust of research. But what a bunch of researchers said is, you know, computers make these weird mistakes that we don't think humans make. But if we give people the two choices that computers sort of like have, do humans go wrong in the same way that computers do?
And what did they find?
And the answer is, yes, they do.
I don't doubt that.
And so this is perhaps not entirely surprising if you sort of like drill down into the details of it. But nonetheless, what they're suggesting is that it's actually a lot easier to get humans to think in a way like computers. And that doesn't necessarily mean a good thing, right? Because although we tend to think of computers as being amazing in terms of the arithmetic they can do, the overall algorithms that run them, other than sort of like the new AI algorithms that are coming out, are somewhat sort of very prescribed and not as amazing as the sort of processing that we can do on images. So nonetheless, the researchers said, let's strip this down. Let's give people some images and then say the computer has a choice between these two particular things. What would you pick? And most of the time, they go wrong the same way the computer goes wrong, which I think is really interesting because we tend to think of the computers as just being like making these mistakes randomly, but they don't. They make mistakes in a very specific way. And in fact, humans can mimic exactly those mistakes. So I think this is a really interesting thing to learn about the way computer algorithms work, because we don't tend to think about it. We tend to always try and make computers do what we think we're doing, whereas this is a much better way of doing things in terms of understanding the mistakes that get made.
Well, this is all about advancing artificial intelligence.
Absolutely. Yeah. So this is really, I think this is just a fun little study because, I mean, we sometimes get a bit cynical about how computers fail at things and sort of like joke. Like, so computers can, with image recognition, it's really a very difficult field. And so you can literally change, in some cases, one or two pixels. Pixels are each of the points that make up an image. In some cases, you can create an image where you change like one or two pixels and the computer thinks it's something different. A human wouldn't ever really do that, right? If you have a big enough image, a human wouldn't do that. But if you... Nonetheless, this is a really interesting piece of research just showing that computers are fallible in the same way humans can be fallible as well.
Because I've got this Google apparatus at home there. You ask Google and it does all this stuff. I'm amazed at, again, the interaction that you can have with this Google and its ability to respond just like that. And almost even have almost a sense of humor, even, it seems.
Well, so some of the sense of humor stuff they are deliberately putting in.
Yeah, I'm sure of that.
So that's a bit of an entertainment thing. But it's certainly true that a number of the digital assistants have reached the point where, yes, you can have a conversation with them about a reasonable topic. The one thing that I do sort of get a little bit disappointed, you say, tell me about something. And then they'll go off to the internet and say, Wikipedia says that blah, 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 blah. And you're like, I could have gone and done that myself.
Yeah. Right, but ask, I don't know if you've got one of these things, but you can ask it all, anything in the world, really. But one of the things that results in a bit of a funny reply is ask it if it's a fire engine red. Just ask Google sometime.
Okay. Yeah. No, I'm going to try right now. Okay. I'm literally going to try on air.
All right. Well, let's see. Okay. Here we go.
Okay, Google. Is a fire engine red? Yeah.
What did she say?
She just found some results online.
Oh, all right. Well,
it.
Okay. All right. Well, let's move on. Caller wants you to
Google fail.
Yeah, Google fail. But a caller wants you to explain Steve. Steve, it says here, is an atmospheric optical phenomenon which appeared as a purple and green light ribbon in the sky, formally discovered in late 2016 by Aurora watchers from Alberta, Canada. They've given it a name, Steve.
Oh, that's actually really difficult space physics.
Is that what this is?
Yeah, no. So I remember when this came out.
Is this like the Northern Lights almost?
Or? Well, it was a particular form of the aurora that was kind of perplexing people. And so I know the story of who explained it and so on. I think it was a space physics group at the University of Calgary who came up with the explanation for this. But it's a really difficult... you see, I'm struggling because I can't remember all the details, if I'm completely honest. But it's a very sort of detailed and unusual piece of space physics involved in the sort of low density plasmas in the atmosphere. And so I think the key thing with the story was that it was unexpected because we kind of felt that we understood most of the particular kind of physical mechanisms involved in creating aurora and so on. And so Steve was a really sort of a new phenomenon, a new type of piece of physics in this that was explained relatively recently. I think it was last year or something.
Yeah,
it was
just recent, yeah. All right.
So the short answer is that's actually some pretty complicated physics, and off the top of my head, I can't, but I do sort of know the background behind the story.
All right. A toilet seat that detects congestive heart failure is getting ready to begin commercialization.
We'll get to the butt of this story.
Yeah. Good line. smart toilet seats. What's next, I wonder?
No, I love this story, actually, because this is about testing people who have gone home after having some form of congestive heart failure and monitoring them.
Yeah.
So any doctor will tell you post monitoring people in hospital and so on, sending them home, one of the biggest challenges is keeping track of the patients. And so when you give people home testing, sometimes people forget. But whereas a toilet seat, everyone's got to use the loo, right? So this is a great way of doing that. And so in this particular case, just by sitting on the toilet seat, it can measure, your heart rate, blood pressure, I think oxygenation, blood oxygenation levels. And so you can use, this does come back to a model of following what someone suffering from congestive heart failure, how those particular parameters would look.
Yep.
And so you can then test your data against the model and see whether someone has a significant probability of a recurrence.
Wow.
Right? This is the main thing that's designed to sort of help early warning that someone's about to have a problem once they've gone back home having been treated. And
would it measure blood pressure, for example?
I can't remember whether it does blood pressure. Probably, probably does. Yep. Yeah. So anyway, all of those things will feed into the model, and then you'll figure it out. So why is this being considered? Because it actually would save money, right? So as complicated as this particular Lucy is, and all of the technology that goes around that, you've got to remember that when someone goes home and then has a recurrence of a heart condition, then it costs a heck of a lot of money once that's got worse in terms of supporting them within the hospital. And obviously, you want to help them so they're not in the hospital again, or at least getting some kind of preventative intervention as soon as possible. So in this particular case, they're saying that they could save on 150 patients a few $100,000, which I think is obviously worthwhile doing. And nonetheless, I know it feels a little bit like an invasion of privacy that everything's being monitored when you're on the loo. But
as long as there's no video.
No. Thank God. I mean, seriously, let's not go there. But in this case, I think this is a really neat idea. And once I saw it, I thought, we've got to talk about this.
I mean, technology, it's amazing. I have occasional conversations with Dr. Gillis on Wednesdays about the advances in medical technology. And it seems we, in technology in general, it's in leaps and bounds all the time.
Yeah, no, I think we're just starting to see the cusp of technology becoming... the word I was going to use was invasive in our lives, but maybe that's the wrong word to use because that sounds bad. But pervasive is probably the better word to use. And so in particular, I think we're going to start seeing a lot more wearable technologies over the next few years. I mean, obviously watches, phones and so on.
Shirts now. They make shirts that
And so we've talked about fabrics that adjust to different situations as well. So more and more, I think we're going to see technology coming in. And then with healthcare, it's inevitable that we're going to be able to augment these particular garments with things that monitor different things. Now, the question is always going to be, how appropriate is that in terms of like you being monitored and your insurance costs and things like that? But this is something we have to figure out as a society and come to terms with that, I think, rather than getting too concerned about what this will do in terms of like our privacy of personal information and so on. Although those are obviously serious issues, I completely accept that.
Jamie just emailed, says he's moving outside the city and wants to get a telescope and get his son involved. Any suggestion on a good starting telescope and a good starting point to get into stargazing?
Well, so to be honest, I always suggest to people that if you're not sure whether you're going to like it, then think about using a pair of binoculars, right? Because those give you, in some cases, a much better view. Because when you get two sets of light going into your eyes, you can actually process more information. In fact, there are people who make giant binoculars, which are literally two telescopes clunked together to go and look for comets and low surface brightness objects. And so I recommend literally starting with a good pair of binoculars. Don't get a super cheap pair of binoculars, because super cheap binoculars have the same kind of problems as cheap telescopes, right? But start with some binoculars. They're really good for looking at star clusters and things like that. And then think about moving up to a telescope as well. The one thing with telescopes is there are a lot of really cool telescopes you can buy now that are called go-to scopes, where you just literally set them up. They have GPS, they know where they're looking and so on, and then they go off and you can basically point them. But using a telescope manually is not easy to do, right? And you've got to know which things to look at. And so that's the challenge. So I would sort of do a big shout out to my friends in the Halifax chapter of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada and suggest you come along to one of their meetings first Saturday of the month at St. Mary's and meet with people who really kind of know about telescopes as well, who can give you some really good advice after you've had some fun playing with a good pair of binoculars.
So these are open meetings the first Saturday?
Absolutely.
Oh,
yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Good to know that.
Yeah.
By the way, Gloria just emailed to say Dr. Thacker's red fire engine question to Hey Google was not answered, but Google Home responded to the question. Her Google Home, she said, I thought it'd be cute to pass that along.
That's really cute.
Yeah, and he says Google Home wasn't even in close proximity to the radio.
Yeah, and so it should be, if someone had a radio playing and an Alexa, right? Alexa, is a fire engine red?
Yeah. Or, hey, Google, listen to News 95.7. There you go. Yeah. Nine, make that 10:45. Dr. Rob here on Science File segment, and we'll be back with more right after this. 10:48 with Dr. Rob here on a Monday morning, and Rick is on the line with a question for us. Good morning, Rick.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. AI writes its own code. Is that a fair statement?
Oh, I know exactly why you're saying that. It's a bit more complicated. So you can think of it as the code that goes into AI being like a framework that you then adapt. And that's the thing where people tend to sort of say that AI writes its own code. You can think of it adapting. There are situations in which you can write code that will sort of transmit itself and allow it to modify itself. That's possible as well. I think a number of people who developed computer viruses have actually worked on that as well. But I think in general, particularly if we talk about something called the neural network concept, that's that it's not necessarily changing its coding as such, but changing how it responds to certain inputs is probably the best way to think of it.
Right. There was one, I don't know, I guess it's true, it's anecdotal at least. I never, you know, saw any research, but Facebook had two AI algorithms that started communicating with each other.
Yep.
And they created their own language using English words, but the context was in no way decipherable by the programmers.
Hmm. Yeah, so I remember this story. So that was about the situation where they literally developed their own language for communicating, and this was in translator software.
Right.
And so one of the things they wanted to do was have basically a system that translated more efficiently and more accurately. And then as the neural network was trained, it developed a sort of like intermediate language in the middle that was basically different from all of the languages, but allowed it to go from one particular language to another language through this intermediate step. So that was a big story when that came out, because people were really surprised by that.
All right.
Yes. Well, I'm preparing for Skynet. I didn't know really the significance of it when I saw the first Terminator movie, but you've certainly cleared that up for me. Thank you.
No, I don't want to be alarmist, but it's certainly the case that people should be aware of the influence that AI is starting to have on our lives in ways that we tend to not sort of like think of too seriously. Like one of the things that gets me is how algorithms impact our lives now. Like the algorithm behind Google's search engine influences such a large amount of what we do on a day-to-day basis, and we tend not to think about that. So it doesn't even have to be something like Skynet. It can be like this really pervasive thing that's just going on in the background, and we're kind of oblivious to it at some level.
Appreciate the call, Rick.
I asked a question regarding who knows more, Facebook or Google. And one of my friends wrote on, he said, Facebook, my wife is on it.
Thanks for the call, Rick.
Okay. Yeah, bye.
All right, bye-bye. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Just looking here at Maritime Launch Services, the company behind the Canso Spaceport, has filed its report with the province, a 475-page report that tackles questions about accidents and malfunction scenarios and that kind of thing. And the president of the company says that even in the worst-case scenarios of explosions, fires, or spills, he says the public and environment will be safe. Do we believe him?
I know why he's saying that. So the key thing is the flight path, I think. That's something to be aware of. And so let's be honest. Accidents happen, right? And so you have to prepare for them. So they are preparing for them. And they're releasing their documents so that we can look at it and give public commentary. I think we've got probably about 21 days left on that period now or something like that. So the concern for me is probably more spills, like they'll have hydrazine there and so on, and what all of the protocols are for cleaning that up. In terms of where they're actually building the spaceport, they're on top of a big slab of granite, I think. So so I think that is actually, to give credit to them, a sensible place to do that.
Well, he says it's something that if there was a launch failure, he says it could blow a crater 10 meters deep into the granite at the site.
Yeah. No, I mean, you've got basically liquid oxygen and RP1 kerosene, right? So that's going to be a huge explosion. It's a couple of kilometers to Canso. So the probability of there being something coming down on Canso isn't zero, but it's not that high in those kind of scenarios.
It says here, among the most dire situations would be a launch failure at ground zero, which would spew debris within a 500-meter radius, burn all the vegetation and soil in the immediate vicinity of the launch pad, and potentially cause secondary explosions and fires. But the risk, again, to Canso and people is minimal.
Yeah, it's so...
Mm. But yeah. It seems like these guys are, I mean, you know, initially...
They know what they're doing.
Yeah.
They know what they're doing. They've developed other spaceports or been part of developments of other spaceports. So, and all of the things that people are concerned about in terms of the... So kerosene and liquid oxygen, those two things, although they're very combustible, they're relatively environmentally... Well, I won't say benign, because kerosene is obviously not environmentally benign, but they are known things in terms of how you clean up. Hydrazine is a little bit more toxic, and so that's something, again, that we do understand a lot more about, and there are protocols for how we handle that. But I think all of this does have to be taken seriously. We have to look at the issues and then make a decision. So
yeah.
It's a 475-page report. I was going to write an article on it, but I'm not going to do that now. So.
Yeah, give us the Coles Notes version, please.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. 10:55 is the time here. Christina with an interesting question. She wonders, she wants to ask about how your brain stores so much memory and then keeps it there for many, many years.
Well, so that's a good question. In terms of how memories get formed, we're still working on all of the details on that. It's not entirely clear, because there have been stories that we've done recently about how you can actually transfer memories from one animal to another using RNA. But anyway, so the best sort of like viewpoints, I mean, I'm not a neurologist, so I shouldn't say that I'm an expert on this, but storing memories in terms of the connections between the neurons and the brain is generally believed how we have some memory system. But the one thing to remember about your brain is that every time you remember something, you can actually change your memories. We tend to like to think of our memories as being these things that are very rock solid, almost like a DVD playback, right? But actually, no, our memories are very malleable and plastic. And this is one of the big issues with testimony, that you can change people's memories. There's been a lot of research done in psychology on this. You can influence people's memories, because every time you recall something, you can change it a little bit as well, and memories can change over time. So you may, for example, have a friend, and that friend just happens to look like a movie star. And over time, if you don't see them, you think they look more and more and more and more like the movie star, because you see the movie star. And then when you see your friend again, you're like, oh, I thought you looked different. Right. So that's actually a thing that happens, that there's kind of, interference is probably the wrong word. There probably is a technical term for it. But nonetheless, your memories are not as solid as you think they are. And that's always something to bear in mind whenever you're giving information on something.
Of course, then as we get older and the memories start to fade and
memories start to fade, it becomes more difficult to make new memories as well. I have to be honest and say that as I get close to 50, that it becomes harder for me to remember things. Obviously, I would consider that I have a very good memory, because I'm an academic and I do lots of stuff, but I'm finding it. Maybe it's because I'm doing so much, but I need this blasted phone to keep track of things for me now. So.
To me, it's the keeping track of names.
Yeah, there's a few games for that, like when you meet them, remembering people's names on their foreheads and things like that. That's always a good thing. Give yourself something really hard
to forget.
That's
a good idea. Everybody should have their name stenciled on their forehead.
We'll start with you, Rick.
Dr. Rob, interesting hour as always. Appreciate you dropping by, sir.
Oh, it was great. And it's nice to be healthy again.
There you go. I'm glad that you're healthy indeed. Dr. Rob Thacker with us here on a Monday morning. He's an astrophysicist at St. Mary's University, and he joins us each and every Monday at this time for Science Files. All right, it is now 2 minutes before 11 o'clock. We're going to break for a news update, and then it's your turn to sound off. We've got our first open hour of the week coming up next hour. We call it Manic Monday, and anything goes in the next hour. All you have to do is give us a call, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We'll take your calls after the news, and the news is coming up next.